afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming to 31. Oh, no, one Bligh Street. Sorry, I'm forgetful. I'm Alex Oliver, and I'm the Director of Research here at the Institute. And today, a little bit of a change of pace for the Lowy Institute. We're going to be discussing the question of an Australian Republic and what it might mean for our place in the world. With me today, on my left, are Julian Lisa, a Member of Parliament, and Michael Cooney. I'm going to introduce them properly in a moment. But I wanted to start first with a quick little primer on public opinion. As some of you may know, I have a bit of a predilection for opinion polling. A news poll from April this year found about 50% support Australia becoming a republic, and 41% are against it, and about 9% undecided. There were very similar results in the previous 2 years, but there's been a shift in support of a republic since the mid-2000s, when support was around 5 to 10% lower. So such close results, they're certainly outside the error margin for that sort of a poll, but they're close nonetheless, show that Australians really remain quite divided on this issue, albeit possibly with a small shift of opinion in the last decade in favour of a republic. Now, because the Lowy Institute is a foreign policy think tank, we're particularly interested here in the international implications of any proposed constitutional change, and what effect, if any, the issue might have on Australia's standing in the world and in the region. So, ladies and gentlemen, I have a great panel here today to consider this and other important questions about an Australian Republic and the Constitution and our place in the world. Michael Cooney, on my far left, is the National Director of the Australian Republican Movement. It's an organisation some of you with long memories will remember was chaired by former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull leading up to the 1999 referendum. Directly before taking on this role in mid-2017, Michael was the Executive Director of the Chifley Research Centre. He's previously worked as speechwriter to Prime Minister Julia Gillard, as a senior advisor at ANU Crawford School of Public Policy, and a policy advisor to federal Labor leaders Kim Beazley and Mark Latham. Julian Lisa MP is a member for Barara. He was the youngest councillor in Australia when he was elected to Woollahra Council at 19 years of age. Not a very contentious electorate today. He was also elected as a delegate to the 1998 Constitutional Convention. He's worked as an associate for the High Court Judge Ian Callanan before taking up advisory roles with Tony Abbott and Philip Ruddock. He had a stint at the law firm Mallesons Stephen Jakes before he left to head the Menzies Institute. He was a senior executive at the Australian Catholic University for the 4 years leading to 2016, and was then elected to the House of Representatives. Ladies and gentlemen, please join with me in welcoming them today. So I'd like to start by asking you both a bit of a scene setter, a question or two about the state of play on the Republic issue in Australia. Julian, in your maiden speech, which I read to Parliament in 2016, which was very memorable and very moving, you related the story of your 10th birthday in which, and I'm going to quote your words if you don't mind, please, you asked your parents not for a BMX bike or a cricket bat, but for a copy of the Australian Constitution. I think you quite fairly suggested the Latin term for a 10-year-old boy like you was something like nerdus maximus.
Yes.
Later in life, I think you've also been called a little bit uncharitably an old fogey, but we won't go there.
A young fogey, I hope still.
You've been clear that you see our current constitutional arrangements as being the best system of government of all of the available alternatives. I think that's a Churchillian reference. It's been nearly 20 years since the referendum, and that constitution, which you clearly love, remains the same. So how do you characterise the state of the constitutional debate now?
Well, Alex, first, thank you so much for having me here to participate on this panel. It's an honour and a privilege to be here with Michael discussing an issue that I haven't thought a great deal about for 20 years. As I said to you and Michael before we came on stage, I've only participated in one debate against Bob Carr on this issue a couple of years ago in the last 20 years. And I think that's indicative, not just of my slothfulness, but of where the debate is at. This debate has been dead since the Republic referendum. And I think it's been dead for a couple of key reasons. The first is that I think politically the Republic is a poisonous issue. In the 10 most marginal electorates on both sides of the aisle, Only one of those electorates, Melbourne Port, soon to be renamed McNamara, voted yes in the 1999 Republic referendum. And of those 20 electorates, 16 of those 20 voted above the national no average. So this is not an issue that brings anyone credit in marginal seats at a political level. I think that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think that the referendum in 1999 settled the issue, and it settled it in quite a significant way. You didn't get a majority in any state. In fact, the only majority that occurred was in the ACT, and of course there was a national no vote, a significant national no vote too. Thirdly, I think the onus is on the Republican movement to demonstrate what sort of republic they want, how the sort of republic they want will be better than the current system and why we should change in the first place. And over the course of the two decades, with respect to my friend Michael, I think the Republican movement has spent zero time on the details of constitutional change. Because in a referendum campaign, the focus of the referendum campaign is the details of the model. It's about what the republic is that is put forward to change the constitution. It's not about the idea of a republic, it is about the model itself. And it surprises me that the Republican movement under several leaders has failed to address that issue. That's why I think the debate is where it is today.
Interesting question, the model question, isn't it, Michael? Because that is something which appears still divides the Republican movement itself. Now, in your quarterly essay response of earlier this year, you set out a timetable for a national plan, really, for a referendum to be in 2022. So that's just 4 years away, with a couple of questions on A, the question of principle, should Australia become a republic, and B, the question of what the model is. Public opinion being quite divided still on this. You know, how do you see that sort of quite tight time frame working, and this question of the model, how is it going to be resolved?
I think there are many things that have changed since 1999, since the last century, as I like to think of it. One of those is that, 5 million of those are 5 million new voters. And so for those people, they've never been asked, and the question certainly isn't answered by them, and perhaps not for them. And those millions are not only people who've become 18 and entered the electoral roll through age in that time, but also millions of people who settled in this country in that period or become Australian citizens in that period. I think that's a really important change. And I think the second really important change is that the best argument put last century on this question was that it ain't broke, don't fix it. It's a very clever line, and perhaps even an arguable case in 1999. I think if we think that what they were describing was Australian politics, that feels a less sustainable claim to make in 2018. In fact, if it's not broke, it's clearly breaking. And those problems are not only about parties or behaviours, they are in some important ways, I think, the product of the lack of true Westminster balances in our constitution, the weakness of the position of head of state in the Australian constitution. In the 90s, the sort of conservative fear was that a presidency would somehow grow, and frankly what's actually happened is that the Queen and the Governor-General have shrunk. And the Prime Ministership has grown into this kind of Westminster presidential creature, my mate Jim Chalmers, now the Shadow Finance Minister, describes that the Prime Ministership today is a big dog on a short leash, sort of with overweening short-term powers and overweening prestige in the society, and yet constantly being reset. So I think those two changes, millions of Australians ready to consider the issue for the first time, and then secondly, the plain, every indication of political decline in Australia's system, create quite a new context for the discussion. I think Julian's quite right that we need to say, that is, Republicans need to argue for the detail of what's proposed, but also for why it's proposed. I don't think it's only about the model, as it were. And the key point I'd make there is that the detail and purpose and structure of an Australian head of state within an Australian republic isn't a divisive question at all. What's perfectly understood and really always has been by the overwhelming majority of people who either support or oppose an Australian head of state is that Australia's head of state would be a non-executive head of state with the powers of the Governor-General and the Queen, much as operate in plenty of post-Commonwealth advanced democracies like Ireland or Germany or India, and there's a question about how that person should be chosen. But to consider that as the model, well, I know that's the kind of the historical label attached to that question, I really don't think is actually, I don't think it's right to say that that is the, you know, quintessential question. It is a question which needs to be settled for the people, I agree. But I don't think being neutral on that question and allowing the people to decide that question is the same as not having a plan for what it should look like.
Just moving now to beyond our shores and Australia's international standing and the idea of a republic. The idea of an Anglosphere and Australia's part in it has been something that the Liberal Party or its leader has raised on occasion in the past. And a few years ago, former Prime Minister Tony Abbott advanced the idea that there's a group of English-speaking nations sharing similar cultures, values and democratic systems, which helps define Australia's place in the world. We actually polled on that question and we found that Australians were quite divided on that idea as well. Does the monarchy in Australia reinforce the idea that Australia is part of some sort of Anglosphere or a post-colonial group of English-speaking nations with a loyalty to Britain and to the Commonwealth? You know, for other countries in the region, is that something that affects Australia's standing, or does it make no difference, do you think, Julian?
Well, I think two things to say. I think it's a strength that we share the Queen as sovereign of Australia with other countries, that we share with Papua New Guinea, with New Zealand, with Canada, with the UK, with several nations in the Caribbean. I think in a globalising world, it's nice to have that aspect of our constitutional arrangements in common. During the 1990s, there were all of these arguments advanced by ex-trade commissioners, ex-secretaries of DFAT, international business people, that if we didn't become a republic, you know, we would damage our international standing, that the Asians wouldn't understand us and so on. And I think if you look at what's happened to Australia in the 20 years since the referendum, you'd see the exact opposite has happened. Now, our international standing has increased massively in the two decades since the republic referendum. If you look at our participation in international institutions since that time, we got on the UN Security Council, we got on the UN Human Rights Council, we've concluded 8 or 9 free trade agreements with a number of Asian and other nations in our region. We've seen an economic boom continue in Australia such that we have the longest continuing period of economic growth of any country in the world. So the idea that our constitutional arrangements and who's the sovereign of Australia is some issue for our foreign standing, our international relations, is just rubbish. It was rubbish in the 90s and it's rubbish today. People look to Australia to see, are we a free, democratic country with the rule of law? And we are all of those things, and that's why we're able to attract foreign investment. We're a reliable international citizen that believes in the rules-based international order. That's why we're a good partner, and that's why we're a country of standing. And we will be, and always will be, if we maintain the constitutional monarchy or if we become a republic.
We asked this question a few years ago, back in 2014, on what impact a republic might have on Australians' perceptions of Australia and its standing in the world, and the majority agreed with you. 55% said it would make no difference to Australia's standing in the world, with just small minorities, around 20% each, saying that would either strengthen or weaken our position in the world. Michael, do you think that Australia's constitutional monarchy and the link with the former colonial power is a problem for Australia in relation to countries in our region, in Asia, perhaps in the Pacific?
I don't. The traditional argument was that there's not so much a threat as an opportunity cost in not having a head of state to be a kind of diplomat in chief, not having someone who can go and be Australia's president overseas as a diplomat and tradesbroker, and someone who can do what Michael Higgins can do for Ireland and so on. Look, I think that's a marginal good that would arise from Australia having a head of state of our own. But I think the real reason to think about what it means to still be a British monarchical country in this century is that Australia needs to be able to explain not only who its friends are and who its adversaries are, to a degree, but why. And there is a big difference between an Anglosphere and even a Commonwealth. And there's a very big difference between an Anglosphere and a group of like-minded advanced democracies. And I think that in the age of the increasingly complex and emergingly adversarial relationships we have with illiberal powers, Russia and China notably, that we need to be really clever and clear in explaining why it is that we are holding the line and why it is that we are concerned when the head of Interpol disappears. That's pretty weird. And we need to be able to explain that the reason why we're resisting those trends is because they are illiberal, not because they are un-Anglo. We've seen the worst thing that's happened in international affairs in some ways, or the most preventable bad thing that's happened in international affairs in some ways in the last 5 years has been the breakup of a connection between the UK and Germany and France. Like, it is a tragedy and a disaster and a catastrophe in the contemporary environment. And I think it's vital that we can show that the reason why we vote with the people we vote with and the reason why we stand with the people we stand with is because of shared values that are liberal and democratic, not because of kinship, not because of the English language, but because of what we share and believe, and that those things are expandable and that our motives are good.
What about the symbolism of the thing? The Australian flag, for example. Have you got... We had Dennis Richardson here, who's a former Secretary of Department of Foreign Affairs and former Secretary of Defence. And in a conversation with our director, Michael Fullilove, Mr Richardson said that being a republic would possibly marginally help with the way that we represent ourselves. He wasn't strong on the point at all. But he did say that we should have a flag that isn't one quarter of a Union Jack, and that was in fact confusing to maybe not foreign governments, who would know better, but to foreign publics, so as a public diplomacy kind of gesture. Michael, would you think a new flag would change perceptions of Australia?
Well, speaking formally, the Republic movement doesn't have a formal view on the flag. We're a one-trick pony, as my chair likes to say. It is a fact that in Dubai this week, the New Zealand flag has been flapping around the stadium in which Australia is playing cricket against Pakistan. That happened on day one. So in a formal sense, Dennis is clearly right. It is actually confusing because someone was actually confused. I think that the question isn't only one of symbols, though. And I think while symbols have their power, to reduce the question only to symbols, flags, songs, and the head of state as a symbolic question, I think isn't quite what we're talking about. I think the question is not just of symbols, but of institutions. And I think an Australian republic and an Australian head of state that is democratic and that is citizenship-based and that is inclusive and diverse and that is owned by the people, I think that's an institution. And we are lacking something, both in our domestic affairs and in the world, by not having the institution of an Australian head of state, not just by not having the symbol of or having the wrong symbol of our nation.
Michael has cleverly played the two-step on the flag there, and there's a history to that because in the early days the Republican movement was committed to changing the flag, and some of its directors were also directors of AusFlag, but they found in the 1990s that the flag was even more popular than the Constitution, so they quickly separated the two. Look, I think some person running a stadium does in terms of raising the wrong flag, I think there's lots of people running our stadiums in our country who perhaps wouldn't be familiar with all the flags of all the countries of the world, and that's not a reason to change our flag. I've always been in favour of keeping the flag as it is. The flag remains enduringly popular. In fact, again, in the 20 years since the Republic referendum, I think the flag has become even more popular than it was then. I want to go back to Michael's point about institutions because I think it's important. If you take Michael's view that the political system is broken and that things are not particularly good in Australian politics, let's say we accept that's correct. No one is seriously saying that the flaw in Australian politics at the moment is the fact that we have Queen Elizabeth II on our coins, that we have governors general and state governors of high standing that go and represent our interests abroad as other heads of state do in other countries. If there's a flaw in our system, it's the fact that we've had this Prime Minister go round over the last decade. And this is one of the things to bear in mind. I think during the course of the Queen's reign, I think there have been 15 Prime Ministers and I think 12 US presidents. It's very easy for us to say who the monarch of Australia is going to be for the next century. It's much harder to say who the Prime Minister is going to be next week, given our history. And the same history, sadly, is applied at the state level as well. There are things about our system of government that need improvement, but the nation of our constitutional arrangements isn't one of them. It's not something that affects our lives in a negative way. It is an institution of stability in a time of rapid global change, and I think that's a great strength of our system. We are one of the world's six oldest continuous democracies, and it's to be remembered that of those continuous democracies, all but two are monarchies. One is the United States. Their democracy was pretty good, except they had a very bloody civil war in between. And the other is the other republic in that lot is Switzerland. And we borrowed some provisions from Switzerland when we were creating our constitution that I've now had for 32 years. So here we go.
Well, you raise a very interesting point, Julian, about continuity and the Queen. But of course, the Queen's reign cannot last forever. And we have public opinion which suggests that with a change of monarch, the support for the idea of a republic actually increases quite substantially. The results are separated by about 20 points, so say 55% for and 35% against a republic, were Prince Charles to become king. And that hasn't shifted much. So should it matter who the monarch is for this debate? Do you expect there to be a post-Elizabethan surge? And our previous Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, quite famously declared that he was a Republican and an Elizabethan.
Well, given how long her mother lived, we're talking another 40 years into the future where we might be considering these issues. Look, Queen Elizabeth II has been an exemplary monarch. There's wide acceptance of that view in Australia. But I think Prince Charles, if he becomes king, will be an exemplary king as well. I think the opposition to him is somewhat overstated. I think the coming to office or being crowned will change people's view of him. One of the great capacities of constitutional monarchy is its capacity to reinvent itself. One of the effects that was felt on the Republic debate in the 1990s, and I should say my position is all about the Constitution, but given you asked me a question about the monarchy, I'll reflect on it, was that period in the history of the monarchy was a particularly bad period. You had marriages break up, you had scandals, you had the Queen's home went on fire, you had expenses issues. It was a really bad period. We are now in a period where the monarchy is viewed completely differently. One of the advantages of monarchy is it can give you a beautiful thing like a royal wedding and the birth of beautiful little children. No presidency can deliver that because you get a tawdry politician, either a complete non-entity or a hugely divisive figure. I mean, if you have the choice of Prince Charles or Donald Trump, give me Prince Charles every day. And that's what people are thinking of when they think of this system.
Michael, I'm going to get back to the Constitution. The question of a referendum is a difficult one, obviously, because only 8 referenda of 44 since 1901, so in more than a century, have actually been successful. The most successful one being the one which gave Parliament the power to make laws in relation to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and to include them in the census, where nearly 91% of the population voted for that referendum, was a very strong result. By contrast, the result in favour of a republic in 1999 was only 45%, half of that. So where does that leave the prospects for another referendum when it has proven so difficult to get any referenda up in Australia?
I think if you look at I don't think that the history of constitutional referenda is a good guide to the likelihood of winning a national vote on a question in Australia in the next 10 years, whether our question or some other question. I think that the history of referenda is a history of the Parliament putting a proposition to the people for its agreement, mostly about the federal Parliament getting more powers, although not only, and essentially in politically pre-modern times, really. What's succeeding and succeeded is where there's a proposition that is a popular campaign and where the people are putting that to the Parliament rather than the other way around. I think that's what you saw, for instance, in the 60s with Indigenous advancement. And that's clearly what you saw on marriage in the last couple of years as well. Something that was never bipartisan until the last hour. And so I think that the prospects for a successful referendum campaign begin with considering it as a proposition campaign in contemporary politics rather than as a constitutional campaign. The double majority question comes up often. It's rarely been operative. And on my reading, there's relatively little variation between the states and no serious prospect that a majority of Australians would vote yes without that happening in a majority of states. Our states just aren't that demographically different. I think that it can win as a proposition if it's a popular campaign where Republicans sign up to having conversations with their friends about it. The other thing is that what clearly happened last time around, albeit in a very different environment, was that every undecided voter decided to vote no in the last 8 weeks. Now, there are lots of reasons for that, but the main thing I'd say is that whenever we have our referendum campaign on this thing, it won't be John Howard versus Malcolm Turnbull.
Can I just say a couple of things on that? I'm the co-chair of a committee on the constitutional recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples at the moment, co-chair it with Pat Dodson. It's been an extraordinary experience for me going around looking at this particular issue, seeing Indigenous people in different parts of Australia. I'm committed to the idea of constitutional recognition of Indigenous people. But this debate, the debate about constitutional recognition of Indigenous people, has most recently been going since the 1980s. There's a version of it that's been going since the 1930s as well. And where the debate has had some difficulty is, what's the model of Indigenous constitutional recognition? Some years ago, we thought about putting words in the preamble. We thought about, should we have a racial non-discrimination clause? Should we have a clause in the Constitution that says that Section 5126, the racist power, should only be used for the benefit of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples? Last year at Uluru, the statement from the heart said we didn't want any of those things. Indigenous people said they wanted a voice. And we've been trying to work out what the shape of that voice is. When you're dealing with changing the constitution, it is all about the detail. And that's where these debates ultimately come unstuck. And I have to disagree with Michael. I don't think that our politics has changed so dramatically that whether it's on the Republic issue or whether it's on the recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people issue, that you can ignore the basic settings of what has led to constitutional referenda that have been successful in the past. And that is bipartisan support with the Prime Minister leading the charge as well as the Leader of the Opposition. That is proposals that give people rights, that give things back to states, that are of a minor and technical nature. The Republic proposal, at whatever form we have, would be the most radical surgery done to our constitution since Federation. It's a massive overhaul of the constitution. And I think in every referendum campaign, you start off with large support for a yes proposal that whittles down over time, because as people become more familiar with the detail, they have second thoughts. And when you're changing the constitution, it's completely different from giving people the right to marry each other, because what you're doing is you're changing a legal document that is subject to the interpretation by judges, and if you don't like the interpretation of judges, the only thing you can do is send it back to a referendum. And we've seen with all the Section 44 cases during the life of this Parliament and all the by-elections that we've had, that the Constitution's text and structure actually matters. And that's why I come back to the point I made in response to your first question, that the detail is very important in whichever issue we're talking about here, and that's why we need to get the detail right.
And the bipartisanship is going to be a bit of an uphill battle for the Republican movement, given that the way that things look now, even with a marginally in favour vote, it's much, much stronger amongst the Labor Party and the Greens. So this is a partisan issue, whereas the polling suggests that it's not an issue between generations, that all of the generations are voting quite similarly. There's a bit of a gender divide in that women, interestingly, are less supportive of a republic than men. But where the strongest divisions are seems to be along political lines. So how does the Australian Republican movement gain any sort of bipartisan consensus?
Look, I think that you're right to say that voting Labor or voting Liberal is a good indicator of whether you might support or oppose a republic. It's not the only one by any means. It's also worth noting that there's a variety of evidence out there about public opinion, and News Poll has a very similar finding on support to most of those other polls, and has a higher finding on opposition and a lower finding on undecided. than a lot of other polls. And I think that's very interesting and very important. If you're trying to work out how people are going to vote in an election on Saturday and you're calling them on Tuesday night, you can't let them off the hook and say they're undecided. Like, you've got to get at them and make them tell you how they're going to vote, because they're not undecided. They're just being polite. I think on a question like this, people actually are undecided. And so I think that a methodology is designed to reduce the undecided to like 9% is actually not necessarily fitting this, whether it's their panel or their question or their interview style. They're an outlier on undecidedness, which I think is interesting. So that's the first part of that. But more generally, I think that I think I've forgotten the other half of your question, as is probably becoming immediately obvious.
Well, there is a partisan divide, sure, according to the numbers. Yeah. So despite the swingers non-decideds.
Yeah. Look, leaders are important in the way that they will signal support to people who are party identified. And particularly on an issue like this, about which many people don't know a lot, one of the important ways they take a view is based on what their party leaders think, or the leader of the party they associate with. But it's also clearly true that I think the mistake that Republicans, the bigger mistake that Republican supporters would make, is to try to come up with a less popular model with the people in order to retain the support of politicians at a particular point on the spectrum. I think that the core of success is not actually starting by trying to persuade parliamentarians either side of the aisle in some kind of quite defined spectrum kind of concept, but instead to build popular support for a model, as it were, which people like, and then I think politics will follow. Like, in general, politics follows public opinion rather than leading public opinion. And as I say, we notably saw this in the marriage debate, which was hugely controversial, of which politicians were terrified, which was never bipartisan. Which were the votes on specific, you know, protections and exceptions on the last day weren't bipartisan. Poor old Minister Bishop walks into the Parliament and literally does a kind of a 1-2 trying to work out which side she's on, because she'd been busy running the country, in fairness to her. But like, that didn't start with a politically bipartisan approach. It started with a politically independent campaign and an idea that people ultimately were persuaded to support, and it certainly didn't start with a winning majority. I mean, we are miles in front of where marriage was 4 years before success on a 50-35. So I think that bipartisanship understood as support of the opposition and the government is a trailing indicator rather than a leading indicator of success.
I just want to go back to a point of constitutional history here. In 1967, you mentioned the referendum to give the federal government power to make laws about Aborigines and to count Aboriginal people in the census. On that day, as you said, about 91% of Australians voted yes. That was terrific. Great result. People forget that at the same time there was another question put which failed. And it had bipartisan support. Both leaders supported, but seven senators and one of the state premiers opposed it and managed to defeat the particular proposal. In 1977, the last time we voted yes to change our constitution, there were four questions put. All four had bipartisan support at the national level. On the fourth question, I think it was in relation to the size of the House and the Senate. I think that was what it was about. You had a number of senators again and a couple of state premiers defeated. When I was on the no side of the Republic referendum, a side that I suspect I shall always be on, I thought we were pushing it uphill for most of the campaign. But considering this issue from the perspective of the constitutional recognition of Indigenous people, you realise how few people can actually kill a referendum according to our political history. Now, I take what Michael is saying, but I think we are silly to ignore that history. And I think on this question, you will always have a substantial number of coalition MPs who like the current system. It's been an article of faith for large parts of the coalition since the founding of our two parties. So I think getting bipartisan support for a yes vote will be very hard.
Yeah, look, I agree on that. I mean, I think that's what, in turn, why thinking of the starting point as being getting bipartisanship, much less, as you say, getting consensus. I mean, that is an absolute mirage. Like, if step one, get political consensus. I mean, it's Australia, it's 2018, right? You can't get political consensus on free beer. Right, particularly in the contemporary media environment, like, it is literally and formally impossible that you're going to put a proposal in a referendum which won't have a prominent Australian opposing it. And the idea that the starting point is that, I just think is that we haven't seen that. That doesn't succeed because it doesn't exist. I mean, that's just first have a miracle and then you'll get a successful referendum. So I don't start from that point of view at all. I think what we've got to do is say, here's a problem in our country. Here's our divided, unprestigious, distracted, nasty short-termist politics. Here's part of the solution, which is to have a fair dinkum Westminster system in a way with a prestigious, unifying figure above it all, not an absentee, who can actually play a role. And that will make a difference and it will help. And that persuasive argument has to be the starting point.
Well, that's a good starting point for opening up to our audience. We now have about 20 minutes of question and answer, and if you just identify yourselves and keep your questions to questions and not comments. And we've got one up here in the back row.
Hi, my name's Jeremy Tarbox. I've got a question for Julian. Julian, a kind of parallel question to what we're discussing. Would you ever support a Governor General who was not an Australian citizen?
Well, we've had Governors General.
I'm talking about in your term in Parliament.
Look, I think we've... One of the things with the Australian system of government is that it's evolved, and it's one of the strengths of the system of government. And I think today it's very unlikely that we would see anyone other than as an Australian citizen as Governor General. I don't know who it would be. If you're saying to me, would I support Prince William or Prince Harry becoming Governor General? You know, I think we should leave that possibility open. But I think in the main, the likelihood is that we are only going to have Australians serving in that role. But you'd have to gauge public sentiment.
Hi, my name's Ian Lynn. I think we're all barking up the wrong tree. I think we're looking at the path and say, how do we continue on with the path with slight changes? I think the future is going to be completely different. I believe our present forms of liberal democracy are going the wrong way. Everyone believes that. And the reason that the whole constitution or the voters are totally confused about what the future is going to be under our present system. So I think we'll step back, wave a magic wand, not say we're going to do it or not, but someone's got to say, here are all the totally new possibilities. Why do we need 6 states, 2 territories, a national government, 9 jurisdictions for 25 million people in the cyber age? What's that going to cost us?
Well, okay. I think if I can stop you there, I think what the question might be there for you, Julian, and I know this is something you've been interested in, is the idea of federalism and perhaps some duplication of these layers.
Yeah, if we do have a major problem in our constitutional system, it's the federation. The federation doesn't work as it was designed. Alex kindly mentioned my maiden speech. I spoke about 2 things in my maiden speech, principally my father's death by suicide 22 years ago, and also the reform of the Federation, because I think that's what we really need. I think there's major economic benefits from the reform of the Federation. Most people have looked at the Federation and said what we need to do is centralise more power in Canberra because, you know, the states have failed. I actually think we need to start thinking about it the other way around and look at where Canberra can get out of the way and devolve some of its power back and give the states adequate financing. I mean, look, we've had another debate in recent months about the GST. I said in my maiden speech I would look to try and find reform partners in other parties who are interested in this topic, and I did look with honest effort, but I wasn't able to find anyone on the other side who was genuinely interested in this. And it absolutely is. We need to get some political consensus on the reform of the Federation, because I think that's the major economic challenge. It affects people in a social policy sense when they're dealing with education and health, when they're dealing with infrastructure questions, because both levels of government seem to have their hands in both things, and so no one's really accountable and there's endless duplication. So I think that if you could talk about what is the big constitutional challenge Australia faces, that is the big constitutional challenge.
Can I play a devil's advocate then? You're opposed to a constitutional change, and you talked about the difficulty and what the sort of radical constitutional change of the Republic might be, but the sort of change that you're talking about is quite radical as well.
You don't need to change the Constitution to affect the Federation. That's the advantage of it. It needs a political settlement, but it needs a settlement on a bipartisan basis at the federal level, and it also needs the bipartisan basis at the state level. When Bob Hawke and Malcolm
Section 51 of the Constitution and the powers of the Commonwealth.
My view is we can spend a lot of time dealing with referenda, which expends a lot of national energy to get very little result, because you might still get a no vote. Instead, we should work within the constraints of that fact and see what can be achieved through negotiation at the federal-state level. When Tony Abbott was Prime Minister, he had a federation white paper process. He had people involved in that process, people like the late John Bannon, and I thought that was a really good process and it was a good issue. And I would like to see us revisit that and re-examine the division of finances and the division of responsibilities, but I don't think we should be saying, well, our first stop is let's amend Section 51. Our first stop is actually what can we achieve to make the Federation work better through political agreement, where we devolve more, but you need that political agreement first. And certainly if you're going to change Section 51, you absolutely need the political agreement too.
If you're looking for people who are interested in abolishing states and you want to debate against, I suggest Jim Snow or Arthur Chesterfield Evans. A question for Michael. We look at European presidential democracies. You can contrast somewhere like Ireland, where the president is above politics. Or, on the other hand, you can have somewhere like France, where the president is very much down in the muck. Now, if we have a model, if we want our democracy to be more like Ireland's and less like France's, how can we do that? How can we make sure that happens, assuming that's what we want to do? What controls do we have over via the model, I guess, which will allow us to determine what sort of democracy we end up with?
Yeah, but that's a really good question, because I think it is really clear that what Australians who want a republic want is a genuine Westminster parliamentary Commonwealth republic of the kind that a number of those countries have, not all former Commonwealth countries either, with a non-executive president who does that job properly. I think the first thing that governs that, frankly, is the conventions and sentiment of the Australian people. But that's what we want. There are very weak incentives for a future Australian president not to behave that way. The best reason we won't go to Donald Trump is because Donald Trump's an American. He's not going to be eligible in the ballot. But more precisely, he won't have the powers. So a future Australian president should have the powers of the Governor General and the Queen at the moment and combine those in their office, and should be governed just as the President Governor General is governed by convention as well. I am constantly struck by the concern that features of the present constitution, if retained in a future Republican constitution, will destabilise our country. The question you pose, which is a sensible one, how do we ensure an Australian head of state remains non-executive, is exquisitely a problem of our present constitution. And it is only the fact that it is an Australian democracy governed by convention and by public sentiment that stops the present head of state or her representative in Australia from acting with extraordinary plenary power. What would stop them? Well, we would stop them. And what would stop them is they're one of us and they won't do it. So I think that we should have some confidence in our system. But the further point is this, that the great concern of monarchists and constitutional conservatives traditionally has been about some future evolution of the system under which the presidency strengthens, by contrast to the present Governor General and Queen. The problem is that actually the head of state now, in their role in the country, both unifying and political and social and other, is weakening. And we are seeing an imbalance emerging, and it is not the imbalance of some fancied elected president becoming some kind of constitutional behemoth. It is precisely the fact that the Governor Generalship is disappearing. The present Governor General is so famous in Australia that he was in VB ads before he took office. He was an Australian of the Year, right? And you've never heard his face or name since he took office. That is a real loss for us. When the Prime Minister wanted to go to Beersheba on the centenary of the charge there, the first striking thing is that it's the Prime Minister who goes. Right now, obviously, the Governor-General is there as well, but we all know who the more famous and prestigious and important Australian is, and it's the head of government, not the head of the state or some unifying person. And secondly, the Prime Minister nearly missed the thing because he had to deal with one of Barnaby Joyce's many farcical fiascos. And he was literally held up for 18 hours. And they thought he wouldn't get there. That's a real problem for us, and it's because of the decline of a proper Westminster balance in which prestige and power are separated and in which we have a unifying head of state who actually does the job that we need them to do.
I don't quite know what you see as the Governor-General's role that he's not doing, Michael. I mean, I think Peter Cosgrove is widely respected, and he goes around and attends many public events and adds a grace to public life when he does so. He attends many overseas commemorations for the centenary of World War I. I'm not sure we would want the Governor-General to become a more politically powerful figure. We've had the closest we came to that scenario was Sir William Dean, when he would occasionally sail very close to the wind, speaking out against public policy of the day. I can tell you, if you have an elected president, you will get somebody, because they've got a mandate, who will speak out against the government of the day. If you have somebody who's elected by one party as the president and a different party as the prime minister, and you will have a real tension in the system that we've managed to avoid in our system so far. One of the great things about the Australian system of government is that the Governor-General knows they don't have any mandate, because they are there as the representative of the Crown. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. And they know that their conventions have to be exercised in accordance with the traditions of the Crown, because they've got to bring honour to the Crown, and because the reserve powers come from the fact that there's the Crown here. There was lively debate about the nature of the reserve powers and their transition to a Republican form of government in the 1990s. Gareth Evans, a Republican, said it would be the labour of Hercules to properly codify the conventions. And some of these things are very controversial when you consider the events of November 1975, when Gough Whitlam was sacked. We can't afford to just skate over these things as if they don't exist, or as if they'd automatically transfer one system to another. That was the view of several Republican constitutional lawyers of high standing in the 90s. Nothing has convinced me that that has changed.
Hi, I'm Trish Marinozzi. My question's to Julian. You were touching on your role as a co-chair for the Indigenous recognition. How can true Indigenous recognition take place in this country if First Peoples do not have the opportunity to actually be a head of state of their country?
Well, what has surprised me, pleasantly so, in my consultations is the number of First Nations people who are constitutional monarchists. So I remember at the Constitutional Convention in 1998, people like George Mai and Neville Bonner and Burnham were all great constitutional monarchists. Pat Dodson, my co-chair, not a monarchist, but he famously said he never had as good a hearing from anyone in Australia as he did when he saw Queen Elizabeth quite close to the eve of the Republic referendum. One of the things that I think will surprise you is that a lot of people who are on my side of the Republic debate are on the side of seeing constitutional recognition of Indigenous people succeed. And before I was a parliamentarian, I founded an organisation called Uphold and Recognise to try and encourage people who are on that side of the Republic debate to get involved, to vote yes on the Indigenous recognition issue, because I don't think the two issues are separate. Indeed, some Indigenous people see that their eventual agreement that they want to see, or agreement making ultimately, has to be with the Crown. So they want to keep the Crown because that's the people, that's the institution under whom Australian sovereignty was claimed for Britain, and so they want to they want to maintain the Crown for that purpose. So it's an interesting and more complex debate than it's sometimes thought.
Michael, you've written on this point, haven't you?
Yes. I think the role for the Republic movement in this debate is to be a good ally for Indigenous leadership and communities, which in turn means that we should be supportive and stay in our lane. So I don't take a view about like when recognition should be voted on, in what form should it occur, you know, in what year, how many treaty or treaties are there, what's the voice look like. I just don't think it's right for the Republic movement to trample in that space. Our job should, you know, we've got two ears and one mouth for a reason in this area, and it's complicated. I do think that part of the energy for change in this area has to incorporate how to honour the fullness of our history. I think that the Republic is a question of inclusion and diversity, yes, but it does some things and is relevant to some things which recognition isn't. So I don't think that either is a substitute for the other. And I don't think, I certainly don't want, and I agree with Julian strongly, like I don't want support for either to be conditional on support for the other, because I don't think that's good for recognition. And it's certainly not for us to sort of, you know, hitch our bandwagon to that star. So, you know, I'd encourage you to vote yes whenever the question's put and in whatever form it's put. But that's as much as a Republic movement should say, in my opinion.
I wanted to go back to the issue of the Commonwealth briefly, because you touched on this, Julian, earlier. Alan Gintle, who was our former executive director, our first actually, wrote about the Commonwealth back in 2003. Now, things have moved on a bit since then because, of course, now we're dealing with a Brexit world. But he wrote then that the main reason we're still a member of the Commonwealth is that the Commonwealth doesn't matter. He said no one cares enough and it's hard to get fussed about it, and the only reason we're there is because it would take more effort to walk away than it would to stay. What role is the Commonwealth now play, and does the Brexit situation make that different for Australia?
I think that's obviously a very negative view of the Commonwealth. It's a view with which I disagree. I think the Commonwealth has never quite reached up to its potential, and for a country like Australia, which is one of the world's oldest continuous democracies with a very strong democratic tradition, it probably means less to us than it does to some of the smaller emerging nations that have joined. I mean, the fact that Mozambique, that had no connection to Britain, decided to join the Commonwealth says that there's some benefit to being in the Commonwealth for countries in Africa, at least. I think it enhances our diplomatic arsenal. It's another badge that we can that we can put on. It builds a relationship. And, of course, the Commonwealth Games is always universally popular. When most Australians think about the Commonwealth, they think about the sporting event. And that's a good thing. It brings people together. We win more medals in the pool than on any other occasion. Australians get to know the words of the national anthem extremely well at the end of the Commonwealth Games because we just win so much stuff there. And I think that's I think it's not a bad thing. I also think it's not bad that, you know, we regularly sit down with the leaders not only of the English speaking, England, Canada, Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, but that we sit down regularly with the Indians and the Pakistanis, with the Malaysians, with the Singaporeans, people who are really important to our future, both in a trade sense and in a geostrategic sense, and we just have another link with them through that. So I see it's a benign force in our world.
Speaking of benign forces, now, one of the excuses for having an event on the Republic was the upcoming visit of those very famous young royals, Michael. And you know, with all of the soft power that the British royalty is able to project, particularly with these younger generations, and taking into account, and without meaning any disrespect to the idea of a King Charles, there would certainly, it may be that the popularity of the Queen could somehow skip a couple of generations and invest itself in the next generation of royals. Is that something that the Republican movement is thinking about?
Well, they're great representatives for their country, there's no doubt about that, and they're popular. There's better evidence of the effectiveness of water divining than there is evidence of a connection between voting intention on the Republic and sentiment in favour or against the Queen's grandchildren. And in fact, they're really popular because that's normal for royals, right? Like their popularity is that of their grandmother, it's that of the brothers are as popular as each other. The outlier is Charles. So in the UK, where people know all these names well enough to rate them, approval of how they're doing their job is like 85 in favour, 5-8 against for all the royals. For the Queen, it's like 93. You've basically got to have a mortar plate in the backyard if you don't like the Queen's, the way the Queen's doing the job. And Charles and his wife are 40-40. Like, they have politician numbers. And not like they have opposition leader numbers, not even Prime Minister numbers. They're clangers, right? And they're... When the Commonwealth Games was on, we saw a bit of a picture of the future that, you know, we're both probably arguing for on different sides. So on the one hand, we saw great Commonwealth republics come together in this very friendly environment, as you say, India, Pakistan, Singapore, and for that matter, non-British monarchies too represented there, and our friends in Africa and the Caribbean and the Pacific. So you saw that part of our future, which we would remain under a republic. In fact, we joined the majority of nations in the Commonwealth as in having our own head of state. But you also saw what a future King Charles looks like. And, you know, it's his wife who's been flown at our expense and then put up in Wagga for 2 nights to recover from the 20-hour trip in BA first class and on one of our planes, who's given one job, which is not to look bored rigid. and demonstrably fails, right? They're unpopular because of the entitlement and lack of transparency that they bring to the role, not because of the tragic events of the 1990s. So it's true that the young ones are super popular. Like, I don't know if you've seen the YouTube of Harry when he's being interviewed in Afghanistan, and then the helicopter alarm goes off and he rips this thing off and tears out there in his boots. Like, it is pretty inspiring. But, you know, we did have thousands of blokes do exactly the same thing, all of them Australian citizens. And I think he'll be welcomed in a very friendly way as a friend of Australia to a big Republican event, an event with, you know, a lot of Republic athletes, a lot of athletes from Republics who've been among our like-mindeds in the world will be here in chairs and on calipers next month. It'll be exciting and inspiring, but it'll be a picture of the kind of nation we actually want to be, which is with a visiting British royal as a great friend of this country and as a guest, not as a host.
As I think I said earlier, the great capacity of the monarchy is its capacity to reinvent itself. The whole institution was not very popular in the 1990s, and it's had a transformative effect today. And I dispute what Michael said about Prince Charles and his visit here. People still turned out in large numbers to see him. The fact that we chose, while he was here, to send him with us, with the foreign minister, to Vanuatu, I think is highly significant.
I agree.
And I think it actually shows the importance of the Pacific and the important role that he could also assist us in playing in that regard too. And the fact that we chose to use him in that regard shows that there was a benefit to him being here in a diplomatic sense too, which I've never seen us use the monarchy in such a form. I don't doubt that when Prince Charles eventually becomes king, he will reinvent the institution and it will retain its popularity in this country, because it's about the institution at the end of the day. It's not about the individuals. We've had mad kings, we've had bad kings, but it's the institution that survives.
Is it possible that the people turn up because they already paid it, might as well have a look?
Well, no, I mean, I think people used to say in the 1990s, again, oh, nobody comes out for a royal tour anymore. We didn't have a lot of royal tours in the 90s, to be honest. But the fact that people did come out in significant numbers to see them is indicative that they are less unpopular than my friends would like to make them out to be.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that our time is up. I think we've heard some highly effective advocates on both sides of the question. I want to thank both of our panellists, Michael Cooney and Julian Lisa, for coming along and spending the time today and defending their corners so very effectively. Thank you very much. And thank you to you all for coming.